Okay, so how far did we get? We introduced differentiable manifolds, tangent spaces, and cotangent spaces, and then we looked at tensor products of tangent and cotangent vectors, and we arrived at tensors. And we found that contravariant tensors, tangent vectors, are contravariant. 1, 0 tensors are tangent vectors, and covariant 0, 1 tensors are cotangent vectors. There is something special about cotangent vectors and cotangent spaces and their tensor product. There is something that they can do that the tangent vectors cannot. Namely, we will use the cotangent vector spaces and their tensor product to define so-called differential forms. And in principle, we could do a very similar construction for the tangent vectors and their tensor products. But it wouldn't be useful. Cotangent vectors, the construction that we do, will allow us to do integration on differentiable manifolds. And that has to do with, from the physicist's perspective, the special transformation properties of cotangent vectors rather than tangent vectors. Exactly why that is and how that happens, we will see, not today, but a little later. So today we will study differential forms. And at the end, I will go a bit on a tangent up into the stratosphere of mathematics. I hope you like that. It'll be about category theory. Okay, so let's start with differential forms. Differential forms is a terminology that is short for exterior differential forms. But we will generally just call them differential forms. They are important because they're needed for integration, as I said. If you want to do an integration in p dimensions, then you need a P form, a P differential form. And that goes for one dimension, but also for any other number of dimensions. Any integration you've ever done was integration over a differential form. So what are differential forms? Let's start with a little bit of a preparation. Consider the cotangent space at a point P. To make things concrete, let's always, for now, stick with one particular point P and its tangent space, its cotangent space, its tensor space. And then we can later generalize that to the entire manifold. So consider the cotangent space to a point P of our manifold. Remember, it's denoted by TP of M star. The star denotes that it's a cotangent space. There would be another notation too that indicates the exact same thing. And that's if there's a 0 up here and a 1 down there. Because the integer down here says it's how many covariant tensor products of the cotangent space you have. And here you have how many tensor products of the tangent space you have. What I'm saying is that the cotangent vectors are 0, 1 tensors. Now each cotangent vector is a linear map, if you remember. Each cotangent vector is a linear map that obeys the Leibniz rule. What does it map? From where to where does it map? A cotangent vector omega maps tangent vectors into real numbers. So if xi is a tangent vector, then our cotangent vector omega maps it into the number omega of xi. Okay, so every cotangent vector is a covariant tensor of rank 0, 1. Okay? 0 times contravariant, 1 times covariant. I hear whistling. Any questions? Now, let's consider multiple copies of our cotangent vector space. We take the tensor product of several copies of the cotangent vector space, and we arrive at the tensor space of R-fold covariant tensors. We should put a zero up here, but we usually omit that. So there's no contravariant tensor factor, it's just tensor product of covariant tensors. Now, what does an element of this tensor space do? Well, it's a multilinear map which takes elements of the contravariant tensor space, the R-fold contravariant tensor space, and maps them into R. In particular, you could take R tangent vectors, plug them into those factors there, and get a number each time, multiply them, that's what you get. So, in particular, if psi 1 to psi r are a bunch of tangent vectors to the point P, then our R-fold covariant tensor nu maps these R tangent vectors into a real number. So nu maps a bunch of these tangent vectors into a number that we call nu of psi 1 to psi r. So what we have is that TP of M star is equal to TP of M 1 0. Okay? And then this, however, is the tensor space of R-fold contravariant tensors. These are the guys that go in as input into our R-fold, these ones, right? So this thing has R lower indices, that thing has R upper indices if you write it down in the basis, right? So these guys can be fed into these to produce a number. Okay, so far, we simply considered tensors that are either completely covariant or completely contravariant. R-fold covariant tensors, R-fold contravariant tensors. Now let's look at a subset of the R-fold covariant tensors. The subset of those R-fold covariant tensors that are antisymmetric. Because these will be the ones that we will call the differential forms.
Mm-hmm. So earlier you said the map is multilinear. Shouldn't that be linear map?
It's multilinear because it's linear in each one of these arguments. Sorry.
So we're taking a tensor product of over the sets, right?
Yes, so but it means it's linear. It's linear. Multilinear here means that it's linear in each of the arguments. Linear in each of the arguments, and but it has multiple arguments, so we call it multilinear. Okay. So among all of the R-fold covariant tensors, the subset of those that are antisymmetric is special. And when I say antisymmetric, I mean if you exchange two of its inputs, then the output of our tensor got to be the minus, the negative of what it used to be. So we define those antisymmetric, we define now for every R-fold covariant tensor its antisymmetric part. So we can antisymmetrize every R-fold covariant tensor. So let's assume that R is larger than 1, because if it is smaller, then there's nothing to anti-symmetrize because it takes only one argument. So if R is larger than 1 and nu is an R-fold covariant tensor, then we define the anti-symmetric part of nu to be the image under the anti-symmetrization operator that we call A. And we will call that image nu tilde. So nu is just some arbitrary R-fold covariant tensor, and then nu tilde is going to be an anti-symmetric tensor. Now, what exactly does the anti-symmetrization map do? By definition, the anti-symmetrized version of nu, which we'll call nu tilde, when fed R tangent vectors, will output the following. We will call it the anti-symmetrized version of nu, and concretely, it's going to be this expression here. This is the sum of all permutations of the inputs. So the inputs are R tangent vectors, and we can feed them in any sequence we want, in any permutation that we want. So here we have a sum over all permutations of our R tangent vectors. And how many permutations are there of R objects? R factorial one, R factorial permutations. So this is the sum over R factorial terms. And it does the following. It sums up the value of our R-fold covariant tensor, which is a real number after all, the value that you obtain when you feed it our R tangent vectors according to the permutation, according to one of these many permutations sigma. So this is the sum of all sigma, sigma labeling all the permutations. And then this is the output of the first permutation. This is the first output of the permutation sigma. This is the second output of the permutation sigma, and so on. So this sums over all possible ways that you can feed the R tangent vectors into our R-fold covariant tensor. Each time you get out a number, and you sum that all up with a prefactor that could be either plus one or minus one. And it's plus one if it's an even permutation, and it's minus one if it's an odd permutation. So for example, if you don't permute at all, then it's an even permutation, zero. So that's just a one. If you permute once, then it's an odd one. If you permute twice, it's an even one, and so on. So this is a sum that sums up all possible outputs of nu with all possible permutations, with signs according to whether the permutation is odd or even. This is just a generalization of what we would usually consider to be anti-symmetrization for the case of having more than two arguments. And then we renormalize the whole thing by dividing by the number of terms that we sum up, so 1 over R factorial. It's important that we do this because, as we will see in a moment, this prefactor, this renormalization of our differential form after we sum up R terms, If we put this renormalization factor in here, then this anti-symmetrization operator becomes a projector, which means that if we apply it one more time, then it's the same as if we applied it only once. P squared is P. Right? For a projector, we have P squared is P. So if we have anti-symmetrized once, then anti-symmetrizing again won't do anything extra. And it's good to know that we're dealing with a projector. Okay, so our anti-symmetrization operator A maps covariant P form, covariant P tensors into covariant P tensors. And the output of our anti-symmetrization map is a covariant P tensor that is completely anti-symmetric in its argument. Obviously, because of the construction there. Because whenever we change two arguments, we get a minus sign because of the way that that happens here. Because every odd permutation becomes an even one, every even one becomes an odd one in that process. Okay, so why on earth would we do such a construction? Why would we want to consider specifically the anti-symmetric purely covariant p-tensors. Well, the reason is that the anti-symmetrization also comes up in determinants. And in particular, in a determinant that arises when you integrate in higher dimensions. When you integrate and you change variables, you change chart, then you get a Jacobian determinant. And remember, determinants are completely anti-symmetric. Also, these Jacobian determinants are transforming with the change of chart. Right? They have the Jacobian determinant is induced by a change of chart. And it will turn out that these totally anti-symmetric p-tensors will have just the right transformation properties to match what the Jacobian determinant does in integrals. So in order to define chart-independent integration, we need to have a perfect interplay between the way that these covariant p-tensors, these totally anti-symmetric p-tensors, transform, and the way that the Jacobian transforms. These two will just cancel each other in their action so that we obtain that the integral becomes chart-independent, doesn't change when we change chart. We will see that in detail play out in the upcoming lecture. So let's make these things a little bit more concrete. Consider, for example, the following covariant two tensor. So we take two functions or function germs, f and g, and then we put the d on them. So now this becomes a cotangent vector, and that is a cotangent vector, right? So f is a function germ, but df is a cotangent vector, and dg is a cotangent vector. So the tensor product of the two is an element of the set of covariant two tensors. We call this nu. Now, this covariant two tensor can be evaluated on two tangent vectors. So we can feed two tangent vectors into our covariant two tensor, and we get out a number. Which number is that? Well, we feed these two tangent vectors into these two cotangent vectors, and we obtain df of xi1 times dg of xi2. Remember, df is a cotangent vector. As such, it is a dual vector to a vector, so it evaluates to a number, and that evaluates to a number, and it's just the product of the two numbers. By the way, do you remember how to evaluate this cotangent vector on that tangent vector? Well, df on xi is xi on f, right? That's how we defined it. That's what I wrote over here. So now this is just some arbitrary covariant two tensor. We want an anti-symmetric, we want the anti-symmetric part of it now. So we apply the anti-symmetrization operator on it. A applied to our covariant two tensor is what we call nu tilde of xi1 and xi2. And by the definition above, we have here 1 over r factorial, r is equal to 2, so it's 1 over 2. And then we have the sum over the two permutations that there are, namely that we either feed xi1 and xi2 or xi2 and xi1 into these two factors there. So that's what we obtain. And since this is to be true for all of the possible inputs, xi1 and xi2, we can also simply write that the anti-symmetrization of df tensor dg is 1 half df tensor dg minus dg tensor df. So it's literally what we would expect an anti-symmetrization operator to do. Let's just keep in mind that we have 1 over r factorial always in front. So the next proposition is that A, the anti-symmetrization operator, is a projector, which is to say that if you apply the output of A, if you take the output of A and feed it into A again, you get the same thing as if you applied it only once. Let's check this in the above example. We won't prove it in general, it's just a bit tedious. Let's just check it in our example here. So what happens if we twice anti-symmetrize DF tensor DG? So when we first anti-symmetrize DF tensor DG, we obtain this. Right? That's what the output was. And now we apply the anti-symmetrization operator on that again. Since it's a linear operator, we can first have it act on this, and then we have it act on that. So this 1/2 we can take out of this bracket, and it's here. And then the anti-symmetrization of this gives us 1/2 DF tensor DG minus 1/2 DG tensor DF minus, and then we apply the anti-symmetrization over here, and we get it over there. If we now collect the terms together, we find 1/2 times 1/2 DF tensor DG plus, here we have another DF tensor DG, and it's with a plus because of the two minus signs here, plus 1/2 times 1/2 DF tensor DG. And therefore, we have a quarter plus a quarter, that's a half. So we have 1/2 DF tensor DG, and the other two terms combine the same way, and we obtain this. And the whole thing just becomes the anti-symmetrized version of DF tensor DG. And that's what we set out to prove. If you apply the anti-symmetrization operator twice, it's the same as if you applied it only once, as it should be for a projector. Okay. So we considered the covariant tensors of rank larger than one, right? Because we couldn't anti-symmetrize one vector. Now, for these covariant R tensors, we define the space of differential R forms, and again, the proper full name of them is the exterior differential R forms. We define that space of these differential R forms to be called lambda R of P at the point P of the manifold. And we define it to be the subspace of these totally anti-symmetric tensors. Or in other words, it's the eigenspace of our anti-symmetrization operator with eigenvalue 1. Okay, so the differential R forms are those R-fold covariant tensors that have the property that they are anti-symmetric. And you can check that they're anti-symmetric by applying the anti-symmetrization operator and checking whether anything happens. If they're already anti-symmetric, nothing will change. So the covariant R tensors that are anti-symmetric are called the differential R forms. And we write, in short, if you take the tensor space of R-fold covariant tensors and you apply the anti-symmetrization operator on the entire space, then you obtain what is called lambda R of P, which is the space of differential R forms at that point. They form a vector space because if you take the sum of two anti-symmetric tensors, it's again an anti-symmetric tensor. And if you take an anti-symmetric tensor and multiply it with some number, then it's still an anti-symmetric vector. So it's a sub-vector space. Okay, so if a differential R form is, sorry, if an R-fold covariant tensor is a differential R form, which is to say that it is anti-symmetric, then its image under the action of the anti-symmetrization operator is itself. Now, according to our definition so far, we have differential 2 forms, 3 forms, 4 forms, 5 forms, etc. But we don't have differential one forms or differential zero forms. But there are one tensors and there are zero tensors. Remember what the zero tensors were? They were just functions. And the one tensors, the covariant one tensors, are the cotangent vectors. The contravariant one tensors are the tangent vectors. So we complete the definition now of all of the differential forms by allowing also, or by defining what we mean by differential one forms and differential zero forms. For I equals zero, we define the set of differential zero forms to be simply, well, the real numbers. We're dealing with a point at the moment, right? Point of the manifold. And once we generalize that to the entire manifold, then lambda zero over the manifold is going to be the set of all functions on the manifold, set of all scalar functions on the manifold. And for r equal one, we will also have differential forms. Differential one forms are defined to be the set of cotangent vectors simply. Okay, so zero forms are just functions, or if you just look at a point, a number, then one forms are cotangent vectors, and then P forms are anti-symmetric P-fold covariant tensors. Okay, so our strategy now is going to be this. Having singled out a particular set of tensors, namely tensors that are anti-symmetric and completely covariant, namely those differential forms. Having singled them out, we will consider what structure that set has. We already established that it's a vector space. So if you take any sum of two R forms, you get an R form. If you take an R form and multiply with 7, you get still an R form. So differential R forms form, or P forms, whatever the index is, form a vector space. But we will give that vector space an extra structure, an extra multiplication. Now, when you have a vector space, that you also give a multiplication, especially if you give it an associative multiplication, then that becomes an algebra. So we will now turn the set of differential p-forms from a mere vector space into an algebra, into an associative algebra. For that, we will have to introduce a suitable multiplication. And then once we have the associative algebra of differential p-forms, and we can look at the derivations of that algebra, right? Derivations being linear maps that obey the Leibniz rule. Now, since the algebra structure that we get is actually quite rich, there will be a rich variety of derivations. And many of the derivations that you know perhaps from electrodynamics, such as calculating the gradient of something or calculating the curl of something. This all has to do with derivatives, right? They will all pop out as special cases of derivations of the algebra of differential forms. Okay, so the strategy now is to equip the set of differential P forms with the multiplication so that we obtain an algebra, and from that we obtain derivations of that algebra. And that will give us various notions of derivative taking. The multiplication that we will define for the differential forms is called the wedge product. The wedge product works in the following way. Assume that omega is a differential S form, and nu is a differential R form. So I'll remind you for the last time of these things, it's just a covariant tensor, right? And a completely covariant S tensor that is also antisymmetric. And this is a covariant R tensor that's also antisymmetric. So assume that omega and nu are differential S and R forms. Then, and assume that none of the two R or S is equal to zero. If they are zero, I'll tell you in a moment how we define that then. So assume that omega and nu are differential S and R forms. Then the wedge product gives us a new differential form, and it is an R plus S form. So if we wedge multiply a 2 form with a 7 form, we get a 9 form. So the wedge product indicated by this wedge is a map that takes an element of lambda R of P and an element of lambda S of P and maps it into an element of lambda R plus S of P. And concretely, this multiplication works like this. You take your two differential forms, omega and nu, you map them into what we will call omega wedge nu, and the operation is this. You take omega tensor nu, which is going to be a covariant tensor of rank R plus S, right? Because this is an S-fold covariant tensor, that's an R-fold covariant tensor. The tensor product of the two is R plus S, is an R plus S-fold covariant tensor. However, omega, while omega itself is antisymmetric in its arguments, and nu is antisymmetric in its arguments, the tensor product of the two is, of course, not antisymmetric in all of the arguments that you can feed into this. Therefore, since we want to map antisymmetric tensors into antisymmetric tensors, we have to apply the antisymmetrization operator to make sure that what we obtain is a differential form again. So the procedure is that the wedge product takes the tensor product of the two differential forms, simply viewed as covariant tensors, and then antisymmetrizes that. And then we have some prefactors here that have to do with the rank of the two differential forms that go into this. And in principle, it could be chosen differently, but it's super convenient to choose them like this because of the properties that we will later prove for them. So there is some extra renormalization going on here. Okay, so this is how you wedge multiply two differential forms. Now, if one of the two differential forms is a differential zero form, which is to say just a function, or when we just look at a point, it's just a number, then you can't antisymmetrize. You would ruin it. It would be zero, right? So in the case where one of them is just a number or it's a zero form, then what? Well, we define that when we take a zero form and an S form, then the wedge product between the two is simply just the tensor product between the two, which is the actual product between the two. So if C is just a number, then this is simply that number times that differential form. Let's do an example. Let's say we want to wedge multiply two differential forms of a simple kind. This is a differential form. Why? Why is that a differential form? Why is dxi a differential form? There's nothing anti-symmetric about dxi, is there? No. But remember, one forms are by definition simply covariant vectors. Any covariant vector is a one form. Any function is a zero form. It's a very trivial case. This is a covariant vector. In fact, it's a basis in the cotangent space, right? These guys are forming a basis in the cotangent space. So this is a one form, and that is a one form. So the wedge product of the two ought to be a two form. Now, what is it going to be? Well, it's going to be dxi tensor dxj minus dxj tensor dxi. And why is that? Well, let's see. We take, first of all, the tensor product between the two. So we would have to write down dxi tensor dxj. Then we have to anti-symmetrize it. That means we have now dxi tensor dxj minus dxj tensor dxi. And remember that the anti-symmetrization operator comes with a 1 over r factorial. In this case, it's a 1 over 2 factorial. So it's going to be a 1 over 2. It's 1 half the anti-symmetric sum of, you know, dxi tensor dxj minus dxj tensor dxi. But then we also have this prefactor here, which in our case is 1 factorial, 1 factorial, 2 factorial. That's a factor of 2, which cancels the factor of 1 over 2 that comes from the normalization of the anti-symmetrization. So that's what it is. Right? So there ought to be a 2 over 2 in here. OK, so now we know how to calculate the tensor, the wedge product of two 1 forms here. What are the general properties that can be proven for the wedge product? Well, the wedge product is bilinear in the following sense. If we have two R forms, omega and nu, and some S form, eta, then we can just distributively write it like this. It's omega veg eta plus nu veg eta. I invite you to check these things on your own. And then if you have some number times omega veg nu, then you might as well write this number on the other differential form, or you might as well pull it out of the product of the two. We also have, and that's quite non-trivial, that the wedge product is associative. Okay, so if you take the wedge product of three differential forms, it doesn't matter in which sequence you evaluate these. For that, it's quite important that we have these extra prefactors with the factorials. Okay, so if you take the wedge product between omega and nu, and then the wedge product with eta, or you first do the wedge product of nu and eta, and then with omega, doesn't matter. But of course, that doesn't mean that the wedge product is commutative. It is not commutative. It is what is called graded commutative. It turns out that the wedge product, as defined above, has the property that the wedge product between an R form and an S form is the same as the wedge product the other way around, up to possibly a minus sign. But whether or not there is a minus sign depends on the size of R and of S. So let's check. For example, we did the case of a 1 form here and a 1 form there, dxi, dxj. And we noticed that was certainly anti-symmetric. Let's see if we can recover that. OK, so if this is a 1 form and that's a 1 form, well, then r is 1 and s is 1. So therefore, we have here minus 1 to the power 1. That's a minus. So we have anti-symmetry. Okay. On the other hand, if we had a 1 form and a 2 form, well, they commute, actually, right? Because then we have r equal 1, s equal 2, minus 1 to the power 2. They would commute. So you have commutativity and anti-commutativity both. It depends on what the degree of these forms is. This is graded commutativity. Now, I showed you the example of the wedge product of dxi with dxj earlier, because now we can reuse that. You see, we saw that dxi veg dxj gives us a 2 form. And it turns out that by continuing to do this, by just taking veg products of the dxis, which are basis vectors of the cotangent space, we can actually build up bases of all the spaces of differential forms. from the coordinate basis dxi, or from any other basis that we want. So the claim is we can use the wedge product to build bases of the space of differential forms, for example, the space of the subspace of differential R forms. So assume that the theta I are a basis of the space of differential one forms. In other words, they're just a basis in the cotangent space. One example would be that the theta I could be the dxi, right? So you could have the example that the theta I are dxi, right? But it don't have to be. It could be any basis in the cotangent space. Oh, I didn't need to write it on the board. I have it here. Then, when we take the R-fold wedge product of the basis vectors, where we order the indices, this is not taking powers, these are just the indices, right? Where we order the indices by size, then these R forms form a basis of the space of differential R forms for all R larger than one. See, if R is equal to one, it's the cotangent space anyway. And we have its basis right here. Now, how many are we going to get in this way? How many basis vectors is it going to be? I give you an example in a moment. Let's just look at the general case. How many ways are there to have basis vectors like that, where all of the i's, all of the indices are different from another and ordered? How many? I mean, for example, let's say this could be a five-dimensional manifold. So we have five basis vectors in the cotangent space. So we have five of those thetas. And then, well, how many dimensions would the space of two forms have? Let's see. We can take theta 1, veg theta 2. Now that's going to be a basis vector. We can take theta 1, veg theta 3. Theta 1, veg theta 4. Theta 1, veg theta 5. Theta 2, veg theta 3. Theta 2, veg theta 4, etc., right? And if you think about it, how many ways are there to generate bases like this? Well, n choose r. We have n and we pick r of them. In this case that I just gave you, we just pick two because we just wanted to look at the space of two forms. But generally, if it's r forms, you have to pick r of the basis vectors out of n basis vectors. Right? How many ways are there to pick r basis vectors out of n basis vectors? It's n choose r. And that's the expression in terms of factorials. And if you remember, your binomial coefficients, r cannot be larger than n. If r is equal to n, it's 1. And then if you make it larger, it's not defined. It doesn't work. Why? Well, clearly, you can't pick if this is, if let's say it's a five-dimensional manifold, you have five different thetas, you can't pick seven out of five that are different. Right? Another way to put it is that you can't anti-symmetrize seven if only five of them can be different. Can't anti-symmetrize that. Which also means that on a five-dimensional manifold, there are no differential seven forms or differential 100 forms. Can't anti-symmetrize that. So there are no differential forms of degree r larger than n, where n is the dimension of the manifold, the dimension of the cotangent space. So let's look at this more explicitly. Let's say P is a point of the manifold, and the manifold is R3, just to keep things super concrete. Then the differential one forms are just the cotangent space. The cotangent space is spanned by these three basis vectors, for example, dx1, dx2, dx3, once we've chosen our coordinate system, our chart for R3 in this way. Now, what are the basis vectors of lambda 2, the space of differential 2 forms in R3? Well, that's spanned by taking dx1 veg dx2, but we can pick two other ones, like dx1 veg dx3 and dx2 veg dx3. There's no other way of choosing two out of these three. So it turns out that in three dimensions, the space of two forms is also three dimensional. That's a very curious coincidence that in three dimensions, the space of two forms is three dimensional, which has confused people in the past. This is ultimately the reason why, as we will see in a moment, the curl of a vector is not a vector. The curl of a vector has three components, all right, but it doesn't quite transform right, if you remember. We will see that in a moment. And then the differential three forms are spanned by this one basis vector. That's the only way you can anti-symmetrize three basis vectors if you have only three available. So this is the only anti-symmetric three form up to prefactor. Anti-symmetric covariant tensor, there's only one. So the set of all differential three forms, sorry, the set of all differential forms on R3 is spanned by these guys. Now, in general, we define the set of all differential forms, irrespective of their degree, as the direct sum, as a vector space, spanned by the differential I form, so, you know, R form, where the veg product is a multiplication in that space. So what's going on here is that we take the differential 0 forms, differential 1 forms, differential 2 forms, etc., and we use them as basis vectors in a vector space, hence this direct sum here. So we are now allowed to take linear combinations of differential forms. This goes beyond what we did with tensors before. You cannot add a 2 tensor and a 3 tensor. We're doing this here with differential forms, though, right? So we form the vector space generated by all of these differential forms, irrespective of their degree. And then we give this vector space the structure of an algebra by equipping it with a multiplication, namely our veg product. As we saw, the veg product is associative, so it's what we're dealing with is an associative algebra. And that algebra has names. It is called the exterior algebra, but it's also called the Grassmann algebra, or the algebra of differential forms. Over the point P of our manifold. And it's written as lambda of P. Remember what we are after. We want to define the algebra of differential forms so that we can then consider the derivations of that algebra, which will give us various notions of derivatives in a very covariant way. Okay, so far all of this was happening at a point, but it's straightforward to generalize this to fields. So globally over the manifold. A differential form field is a mapping that associates to each point of the manifold an element in the Grassmann algebra, or in the exterior algebra, or in the algebra of differential forms. And this differential form field is then also just called a differential form. You just drop this extra word field, just like we drop the extra word exterior. There's exterior algebra, exterior differential form, but often the word exterior is dropped. Okay, and we will simply write omega for a differential form field. And then these fields globally on the manifold form what we call the Grassmann algebra of differential forms. And then we simply write capital lambda of M to denote that algebra of differential forms. So now, let's remember, given an associative algebra, it is often useful to consider derivations of the algebra, which is to say we consider linear maps that obey the Leibniz rule. There are quite a number of cases that we will encounter of derivations of algebras, and in particular the exterior algebra has two important derivations that we will cover next. So first of all, the exterior derivation and then also the inner derivation. We won't get to the inner derivation today, but the exterior one we will do. But what do we exactly mean by a derivation here? So the definition is a linear map phi, that will be our derivation, a linear map phi from the Grassmann algebra of differential forms into the differential forms is called a derivation of degree k. And you see, we will encounter various degrees if our derivation phi maps differential S forms into differential S plus k forms, where k will be allowed to be positive or negative. And in particular, we want that this derivation not only linear maps S forms into S plus k forms, but it also has to have the property that it obeys a Leibniz rule with respect to the wedge product. So if we apply our derivation on the product of two differential forms, then the outcome ought to be take the derivation of the first form, alpha, wedge the second, plus leave the first one alone and differentiate the second. This is the Leibniz rule, of course. You may think this is a pretty general definition of derivations. We are allowing, after all, that the degree goes up or down in this. Namely that, for example, one forms are mapped into two forms, but also five forms into three forms. You know, anything goes. But that's not even general enough. More generally, you can also define an antiderivation. It's also a very natural thing. In fact, it's supernatural when it comes to integration. A linear map phi from differential forms to differential forms is called an antiderivation of degree k if, for any two differential forms, we have that it maps the differential S forms into differential S plus K forms, that makes it of degree K. But if the Leibniz rule is a graded Leibniz rule of this form, where the derivation applied to the product of two differential forms, alpha and beta, gives you the derivation applied to the first factor, which the second, and then possibly a minus sign, and then leaving the first one alone and differentiating the second. This we don't know from ordinary differentiation, right? Normally we don't have that. Leibniz rule is just differentiate the first, multiply with the second, keep the first and differentiate the second. And now whether or not there's a minus sign depends here on what Q is, on the degree of our differential form on the left. So if it's a one form, there's going to be a minus sign. If it's a two form, there's not, etc. Now, how do we define such derivations? This is just a general notation for them. But how do we actually come up with one of those derivations? How do we come up with one of these maps that obeys these Leibniz rules? It would seem to be a little tedious because we have to explain how that map acts on zero forms, how it acts on one forms, how it acts on two forms, three forms, four forms, and it gets more and more complicated. Now it turns out that fortunately, that's not so. In order to prescribe what a particular derivation does, in order to say, this is how I define my derivation, you only have to specify how you want it to act on zero forms, that is to say on functions, and how you want it to act on one forms, which is to say how it should act on tangent vectors. And then the rest is induced. And why is that? Well, it's because of the Leibniz rule and linearity. And because the Leibniz rule tells you how to evaluate the derivation when you have the product of two differential forms. But you can always build up differential R forms as products of differential forms of lower degree. So by applying the Leibniz rule sufficiently many times, you can boil down the action of your derivation on R forms to what it does on one forms and zero forms. So let's keep that in mind. That's super important. If we want to create a new derivation of our algebra of differential forms, we only need to specify how that derivation acts on zero forms and on one forms. And then how it acts on all differential forms is induced by the axioms of what a derivation does. Namely, it's linear and obeys the Leibniz rule or the graded anti-Leibniz rule. We will see how that works in a moment completely explicitly. Okay, so the proposition is that because of the Leibniz rule and linearity, any derivation or antiderivation on the algebra of differential forms has the property that it is fully determined if only we specify how it acts on lambda 0 and how it acts on lambda 1. And here we go, trying this out explicitly for our first derivation of the algebra of differential forms. It's the exterior derivative, super important. It is our D again. You will now see that the D that we defined earlier is just a very special case of something much more general. Remember, before, the D was mapping functions into one forms. You take a function f, and then df is a one form. Df is a cotangent vector. So D was mapping zero forms into one forms, right? It was mapping functions into tangent vectors, tangent vector fields. So it was mapping, in our new language, zero forms into one form. Okay. So now we generalize that so that D will act on any differential form you want, not just zero form. So the exterior derivative or derivation is defined in the following way. It's going to map differential forms into differential forms. And it's going to be an antiderivation, meaning that the Leibniz rule will have this extra minus factor there, minus 1 to the power q. And how does it act? Well, remember, we only have to specify how it acts on zero forms and how it acts on one forms. Now, we already know how we want it to act on zero forms. It ought to be the old D that we know. Okay, so we define our D as an antiderivation of degree k equal 1. Why k equal 1? Well, we want that it maps zero forms into one form. Right, so it's got to be k equal 1, because k is by how much the degree changes, right? Which already implies that it must be mapping 7 forms into 8 forms, and so on. Okay, so D is going to be the antiderivation of degree k equal 1, which is defined through the following. On zero forms, it ought to do what it always did. It maps functions into cotangent vectors, namely df. And now we still have to define how it acts on quant forms. Well, we make our life easy here and define the action of D on one forms in such a way that it maps the dxi into zero. It doesn't mean that all one forms get mapped into zero. It just means that these ones get mapped into zero. And what we really have in mind is, of course, that if the one form is the D of some function, then it ought to be mapped into zero. But it suffices if we just specified for these functions. And we always want to write down just the minimum, the bare minimum necessary. So we require that the D is mapping zero forms into one forms in this way. And then we also specify how it acts on a basis of one forms. In fact, I should have been more careful when I said earlier that a derivation is already fully defined if we know how it acts on zero forms and one forms. The statement can be made a bit more strongly. It can be made more strong by saying that a derivation on the algebra of differential forms is already fully defined if you specify how it acts on zero forms and how it acts on a basis of one form. You don't even have to specify how it acts on all of them, just a basis of them. We can already induce how it acts on all one forms from that and how it acts on all other differential forms. Okay, so far that's just a definition. There's nothing to prove, it's just the way we define things. Now let's see what this does in general. How is it induced what it does on general differential forms? So let's work in a chart. We had that D is mapping functions into these cotangent vector fields, and we calculated exactly what it is. Namely, we calculated last time that DF of X is given by a linear combination of the DXi. Remember, we established that these are basis vectors. So the DF of X, being a cotangent vector field, has to be some coefficient functions times the basis vectors. And remember, you have to be very careful here because we are talking about the entire manifold. At every point of the manifold, the DXi form a set of basis vectors in the cotangent space. But every point of the manifold has its own cotangent space, has its own basis vectors DXi. Right? We always call them DXi, even though they are different objects. For each cotangent space, a different object. That's why we keep these things separate, right? What happens at a point and then the entire manifold. And then eventually, once we understand these things, then we get sloppy with the terminology. Okay, so we calculated that the cotangent vector field of F obtained by applying the exterior derivative D is given by this linear combination of the basis vectors at every point of the manifold with these weights in before them. So df by dxi evaluated at a point gives us n numbers, and these are the n basis vectors, and so this is the cotangent vector at that point then. Okay, so we know how d act on functions this way. We calculated that earlier. But now we have much more general differential R forms or S forms. I'm calling it S here. So let's consider a differential form of degree S. How does it look like? Well, here I wrote down a basis vector, but the indices here can run through any permutation of all of the indices, index values that are available from 1 to the dimension n. But we don't have to repeat any of these, right? So then the index 3 doesn't come up multiple times because we couldn't anti-symmetrize that. And also, if there's an index 2 and another index 3, then it will not come up again. It need not come up again that there's a 3 here and a 2 over there because they would be the same basis vector, just differing by a sign. So in order to run through all of these basis vectors, we only need to sort these indices in such a way that they are sorted by size. Just because we know it has to be anti-symmetric anyway. Okay, and then we have these coefficient functions here in front. So these are the basis vectors in the space of covariant of differential S forms, and this is just a coefficient function. By the way, just to be completely explicit, later we will just glance over that. But technically, these are the basis vectors in the space of differential S forms. And technically, there is a wedge here, and these coefficient functions are zero forms. Okay? Let's keep that in mind. We can view this in two ways. We can say these are basis vectors and these are coefficients, but we can also say that these are S forms and these are zero forms. The wedge product of the two is still an S form. And so general S forms are always of that form that they have here basis vectors with coefficients that are themselves zero forms. Now, why is it important to keep in mind that these prefactor functions, these are just scalar functions, right? That these are elements of lambda zero. It's important because if we then apply a derivation on the whole thing, we have to keep in mind that this is a zero form, this is an S form. So we have to apply the Leibniz rule accordingly. Differentiate here this one, keeping that the same, and then keeping that the same and differentiating this. So how do we carry out now the exterior derivative on a differential S form like this? So if beta is a differential S form, d of beta is what? Well, we apply the anti-Leibniz rule. We know that the exterior derivative, by definition, is a differential, is an anti-derivation of degree k equal 1. And so it applies, it obeys by construction, by definition, the anti-Leibniz rule. So let's apply this here. The d beta is then given by the d applied to, well, the product of a zero form and an S form. So first, let's apply it to a zero form. We know what d applied to a zero form does. We know it from this, right? D applied to a zero form gives us the sum over the partial derivatives, and then the dx is there, right? So if we apply that here, if we apply the d on beta, then we have to apply the d on this, leaving that the same, plus leaving that the same, and the d on that. Let's do the first term first. We apply the d on that using this, because this is a zero form. And what do we get? We get this d beta by dxi, and then that's just carried forward from what we had over there. And now we have an extra index to sum over. And then we get an extra term, namely terms of the form d of the basis vectors. But remember, it was one of our definitions that d acting on any one of these is zero. So therefore, all of these terms go away. We could write it all out using the Leibniz rule, but at the end, we would just end up with dds. And that's zero by definition, right? The d of dxi is always zero. So they go away, and we are left with only the first term here. And in fact, one can prove that the d, the way we have defined it now, or that we defined it earlier, has the property induced by how we define it, and induced by the property of the d being a derivation of the algebra. The d has the property that d after d is zero, not only when applied to the xi, but when applied to any differential forms. This will be true. Now we can see why that is. You see, let's apply the d again. If we apply the d again, and what do we get? We get here the second derivative of these coefficient functions, and then we have here the dxk, dxj, because we have now these two derivatives there and the old basis function over there. But the second derivative is symmetric in the two indices, whereas this wedge product is, of course, anti-symmetric in these indices. So therefore, that's always zero. Doesn't matter what exactly the coefficient function is or what the degree of our differential form is, always zero. So what we find here is that by construction, the exterior derivative has the property that when applied twice, it annihilates everything. Remember what I said like two lectures ago. There is an operator called the boundary operator, right? This one. And it maps a manifold into its boundary, where this is the boundary. And then I mentioned that d squared is always zero. If you take the boundary of a boundary, it's empty, right? If you take, let's say, a ball as a three-dimensional ball, so it's the filled thing, like a chocolate ball or whatever, then what's its boundary? It's a sphere. But what's the boundary of the sphere? It doesn't have one, right? And that's just generally true, that boundaries don't have boundaries. And so the square of the boundary operator is zero. This operator is also called the co-boundary operator, and you will later see that it is, in fact, the dual to this thing in a certain sense. You will see how that comes about. And it's beautiful because this is a purely geometric property, that del squared equal to zero. Whereas this is a purely combinatorial thing. I mean, it's just, it has a completely non-geometric origin that the d squared is equal to zero. So that they are closely related is actually quite deep.
So is that because when you're summing up the terms, they add to zero? Because multiplying symmetric and anti-symmetric?
Yeah, that's why. Yeah, yes, because of the sum of terms that are a product of symmetric and anti-symmetric terms. That's why. Okay, so let's look at it quickly as an example. Our manifold, let's say, is R3, and we look at some function f. Then we have that df is this, and we notice that there are three components, right? This is happening in R3, so we have that the tangent vector space is three-dimensional, and so it's the cotangent vector space spanned by the dxi is also three-dimensional, and we have three coefficients here. And the three coefficients are often written in a three-tuple like this, and it is also called the gradient field of f, right? If f is a function, then these things are forming the gradient field of that function. For example, f could be the electrostatic potential, then this would be the electric field. Notice that we just saw that the electric field is covariant, right? It's a covariant vector, not a contravariant one. Okay, so we just saw a gradient field. Now, let's assume, I mean, just applying a little bit what we saw, let's assume that gamma is a one form. So it's some cotangent vector field. And let's assume that it's not necessarily a gradient. You see, this is what I'm saying now is actually going to be quite important. If you take a zero form f, take the exterior derivative, you get a one form. This thing is a one form. It has these coefficients. And it's very important to realize that not every one form, not every cotangent vector field is obtainable as the gradient of some potential function. Not every electric field is obtainable as the gradient of some potential function. Or just mathematically speaking, there's no reason that if you just have three arbitrary functions in here, that they are the three partial derivatives of one single function there. Just generally, that's not going to be the case. So we do get differential one forms by applying the D to a zero form, but we don't get all of them. Now, let's say that gamma is some differential one form and it has no reason to be a gradient, right? It has no reason to be the D of some function. We're just writing down an arbitrary one form now, so it has some arbitrary coefficient functions, dxi. They don't have to be the partial derivative of some phi or whatever. Okay, so it's an arbitrary covariant vector field. Then, let's see what happens when we apply the exterior derivative on that. Remember that if we applied the exterior derivative on a gradient, well, that would be zero because we know dd is zero. But the gamma is now not assumed to be a gradient. It might be, it might not be, but just some general covariant vector field. Then let's calculate the exterior derivative of that. That's going to be a two form now, because gamma is already a one form. And how do we do this? Well, we apply the Leibniz rule here. So what do we have? We have a one form here, we have a zero form there. Or we have a bunch of one forms, bunch of zero forms. And this sum is going to be important, hence I wrote it in red. So the exterior derivative on the gamma is obtained by taking the exterior derivative of this zero form, obtained by taking d gamma by dx, and then the dxj here, right? That's just from knowing how to take the d of a zero form. That's this one form here, right? And then veg this one, just carry it forward, plus leaving this part alone and applying the d on the second one, but that's just the d squared. So that's going to go away. And we're just left with this. Now, so far, we've been summing over I equal 1 to 3. And now we have also been summing over j from 1 to 3. But since this stuff is anti-symmetric, we're going to have terms like dx1, dx1 goes away. Under anti-symmetrization, dx2, dx2 goes away. Also, the dx1, dx2 term is the same as the dx2, dx1 term up to minus sign. So let's reorder things by only considering the terms I smaller j, and then we get two terms, and they are given in this way. Okay. So remember that all of this happens in R3. And remember from earlier that we saw that in R3, the dimension of the space of differential two forms is three. Okay, so there's a three-dimensional space of differential two forms, which means three coefficient functions. Okay, and here they are. So applying the D to an arbitrary one form gives us this two form. This is a basis vector, that's a basis vector, that's a basis vector, and these are the coefficient functions that we just calculated. Now, often, for historical reasons, these three coefficients functions, given that we are working in R3 here, are put together as these in this three tuple, where this is beta 1, the first component, beta 2, beta 3. And then we might say that this is a three-dimensional vector. But we have to be super careful because, yes, it's kind of a three-dimensional vector, but in the three-dimensional vector space of two forms, right? Now, two forms are anti-symmetric covariant two tensors. They are not tangent vectors, they are not cotangent vectors. So these three components here do not transform like a tangent vector. They don't transform like a cotangent vector. They transform like the coefficients of differential two forms, which is super close to how covariant tensors transform, except for a minus sign when you flip the orientation of your coordinate system. So that has caused some confusion in the past. Because what are these coefficients here? You may recognize them as the curl. Right? If you have a cotangent vector field, you can calculate its curl, like the curl of the electric field. You can calculate the curl of a vector field, and that curl is often written as if it was a vector field again. But it is not. These three coefficients, the curl, are really the coefficients of a covariant anti-symmetric two tensor, which is to say of a two form. This is also what is called a pseudo vector field. Right. Okay, now remember from electromagnetism that gradient vector fields are curl free. Okay, so if you have an electric field that is the gradient of some electric potential, then it's supposed to be curl free. That's this, okay? Because the gradient you obtain by taking the d of a potential, and then you apply the d to that one form that you obtain. But we know now what you obtain when you apply the d to a one form. You get this two form whose coefficients are the gradient, right? And we know, of course, that d squared is zero. So if you apply d squared onto an electric potential, then the first d gives you the electric field, but the second d kills it, which now we see is just a statement that the curl of a gradient is vanishing. Okay. All right. Now, we've seen that there are that differential forms can have interesting properties, quite non-trivial stuff. Differential forms can be arising from the d of another differential form or not, right? So a covariant vector field may or may not be the gradient of some scalar field. There's a systematic way of describing these properties. A differential form omega is called closed if the d of it is vanishing. So we know, for example, that the d of any differential form is closed because the d of that is going to be zero because of d squared being zero. Now, however, there's a very important notion, namely that of exactness of a differential form. A differential form omega is called exact if there exists a differential form mu of which it is the exterior derivative. So electric fields are exact if they are the exterior derivative of some electric potential. Okay, so let's just keep in mind those definitions again. A differential form is called closed if it's killed by D. It's called exact if it is the D of some other function, of some other differential form, such as the gradient. But the gradient is a special case where the differential form is the D of a zero form. A differential form could be the D of a five form, could be a six form that is the D of a five form, for example, right? Now, how are closeness and exactness related? Now, this actually depends on the global topology of the manifold. This is a big deal, not the focus of our course, and we are kind of over time, but I'd like to take this as the starting point for taking a trip to the stratosphere of mathematics for the next 5 to 10 minutes, if you give me that time, all right? It's going to be going off on a tangent, but I think it's super cool stuff. Okay, so this actually depends on the global topology of the manifold. It's the simplest case. Assume that the manifold is what is called contractible, which means it has no holes, no handles, which means that we can shrink it to a point in a continuous way. And here's how we shrink that. We define an extra parameter, and as that parameter runs from 0 to 1, we have that the manifold shrinks from all of it into a point. There is a theorem by Poincaré which says that if a manifold is contractible, so it has no holes or handles or anything of that kind, then exactness and closeness are the same. Every differential form that is killed by D is actually the D of another differential form, which is to say it has kind of an antiderivative, right? So let me repeat that. For trivial manifolds in the sense that they're contractible, it is true that if a differential form is killed by D, then it is the D of some other differential form. We know that the other direction is always true. If a differential form is the D of some other differential form, then it is killed by D, right? Because that would be applying the D twice. But the other direction is non-trivial, and it's true for contractible manifolds. But it turns out that if it's not contractible, then it may or may not be true. In general, we only have that if it's exact, then a differential form is closed, but the other way around is not automatic. And this is a tool for classifying the global topology of a manifold. Why is that? But remember that understanding the global topology of a manifold is super difficult, right? Because you would have to, in high dimensions, how do you check whether it has holes or handles? It's very difficult to do this. But to check whether a differential form is the D of another differential form, well, in any dimensions, that it doesn't require any geometry. It doesn't require any visualization or ingenuity. You just have to check, is it or is it not the D of some other differential form, which is an analytic thing you can check. All right? That's what makes this powerful. Now let's take off slowly. Okay? Bigger picture. This is a special case of what I just said, is a special case of a cohomology theory, and it is called the De-Rahm cohomology. I have heard of this before. Now, what is a cohomology theory? A cohomology theory is a map, C for cohomology, which takes differentiable manifolds and maps them into abelian groups. Think about that for a moment, what it does. It's a map whose input is a differentiable manifold and whose output is an abelian, that is to say, a commutative group. Okay, that's what a cohomology is. A cohomology theory is a map that takes a differentiable manifold and outputs a commutative group. You might say, that's not fair, is it? Because a differentiable manifold can be super complex. A commutative group is pretty simple. It's not even non-commutative. It's commutative, right? But that's the whole point. That's the whole point. We map from something super complicated into something that's much more manageable. You see, the map is not just any map. It's a map that has the property that if the two differentiable manifolds are mapped into abelian groups that are not isomorphic, then we need to be able to conclude, because the map is faithful, that the two differentiable manifolds are not diffeomorphic to each other, cannot be deformed into each other. So we take two differentiable manifolds, map them into the abelian groups, and if the abelian groups cannot be isomorphically mapped into each other, then the differentiable manifolds cannot either. It's super powerful because it's much easier to check stuff in groups than it is in differentiable manifolds. So why are these useful? That's what I just said. Now, let's look at the bigger picture than that. What is this business of mapping differentiable manifolds into abelian groups? It's not the usual kind of map. This is not like mapping R2 into R3, right? You're mapping something very, from something that's differential manifolds to something that's very different, like abelian groups. Now, it turns out that all cohomology theories, there are multiple cohomology theories, and they're all mapping differentiable manifolds into abelian groups with the hope of classifying differentiable manifolds. But of course, it's always a simplified picture. So you can distinguish some differentiable manifolds because they map into different abelian groups, but any given cohomology theory is not perfect. And you may have that different differentiable manifolds are mapped into the same group, and so you can't distinguish them. It's like you're looking at it with some sort of milky glasses that don't have proper resolution. So you need multiple cohomology theories to resolve the set of differentiable manifolds better. So it turns out that all cohomology theories are, now I'm introducing two words that are up in the stratosphere of mathematics, and I will explain in a moment. Cohomology theories are special cases. So these maps from differentiable manifolds into abelian groups are special cases of what is called natural transformations between categories. So like the category of differentiable manifolds and the category of abelian groups. And the cohomology theory is a natural transformation between the two. So what is the general picture of this? What is a category anyway? So a category is a set of objects and of morphisms. These are just the names of it. And it, you can think of it very easily. A category is a set. It has objects. So these are our dots in here. And it has arrows in between them. And the terminology is the objects, the elements are called objects. And the arrows are called morphisms. And the axioms are pretty simple. We want that if there is an arrow from A to B and an arrow from B to C, then there ought to be an arrow from A to C. We need to have that. It doesn't mean that there has to be an arrow between any two. It's just that if there is an arrow from here to here and an arrow from here to there, then there's got to be an arrow from there to there. And we also want associativity. So if you go from here to here and then from here to there, you know, whether you combine them this way or that way, it ought to be the same. And also we want that there is for any object, there's a morphism that gets back to itself. If you come up with any of this, any set whose elements obey that, you can call it a category. It's pretty straightforward, and accordingly, there are plenty of categories to work with. Let me give you two examples. Category of vector spaces. Okay, so each dot in here is a vector space. All vector spaces find themselves in this set. Every vector space is a dot in here. Okay? And then, so if you have the objects now, what would be the morphisms? Well, vector space isomorphism. Vector space morphisms. Oh, what is this?
Let's say, maybe.
All right. Okay, so the morphisms are simply linear maps from one vector space to another vector space. Linear maps preserve the structure. So they're called morphisms. Morphisms is from Greek structure, right? So structure-preserving maps. Whether you first add two vectors and then map them, or you first map them and add them then, doesn't matter. So it's easy to check that the set of all vector spaces forms a category where the elements are the individual vector spaces and the morphisms are the linear maps between them. Now, let's look at a completely different kind of category. Let's say associative algebras. So every associative algebra finds itself in this set. And the morphisms are associative algebra structure-preserving maps between any two associative algebras. So any maps between associative algebras that are such that if you first apply an algebra operation and then map, or you first map the elements over there and then apply that algebra multiplication or addition, shouldn't matter. So this is how we define the category of associative algebras, for example. Okay, and so you can imagine that whatever structure you have, be it Lie groups or Lie algebras or whatever structure it might be, you can define a category for them where the morphisms are the structure-preserving maps. But then the beauty of this is that there's a category that there exists a category of categories. Okay? So now every one of these categories, category of Lie algebras, category of abelian groups, category of differentiable manifolds, for example, all find themselves in there. Well, what would be the category of abelian groups? Well, every abelian group is an object. And then the group homomorphisms from one group, abelian group to another abelian group, this would be the morphisms. What about the category of differentiable manifolds? Well, every differentiable manifold is an object in there. And the diffeomorphisms are the morphisms, right? Okay, so now let's look at the category of categories. Every element in here is some category. Okay, so every category finds itself in here. And now we can also have morphisms between them, structure-preserving maps between them. And in particular, we can look at, for example, the category of differentiable manifolds with its diffeomorphisms, and the category of abelian groups with its group homomorphisms, and then look at an arrow between them. Now, these are called morphisms, but they are also called, in the special case of the category of categories, these morphisms in here would be called natural transformations. And so you see how the case of cohomology theory, which are maps from differentiable manifolds into abelian groups, are just a special case of just one arrow in the category of categories, the arrow which maps from the category of differentiable manifolds into the category of abelian groups. and as I said, in the category of categories, these arrows, these morphisms are also called natural transformations and are also called functors. Okay. So any cohomology theory is, by definition, a morphism between two objects in the category of categories. Namely, it is a morphism, a natural transformation between the category of differentiable manifolds and the category of abelian groups. Such a morphism has to map the structures in here into the structures in there, such that it doesn't matter whether you first apply some transformation in here and then map, or you first map everything over there and then apply the transformation there. So in particular, every differentiable manifold has to be mapped into an abelian group. So for example, if M and N are differentiable manifolds, by our functor, by our natural transformation, by our cohomology theory, the differentiable manifold M gets mapped into a group. Differentiable manifold N gets mapped into a group. A diffeomorphism between the two gets mapped into a group homomorphism between those two. And in particular, and this is the whole point of it, if no such group homomorphism exists, and that's something we can in practice verify, if no such homomorphism exists, then no such diffeomorphism can exist either, which is to say we can conclude these two differentiable manifolds cannot be deformed into each other. They're really different. All right, and this is in fact the reason why category theory was first developed. Category theory now contains any structure in mathematics. In fact, you can now build mathematics not just on logic or on set theory. You could build mathematics starting from category theory by just writing down little things like that and the arrows and the rules that the arrows obey. But the very first application of category theory, the reason why it was invented, was for this particular arrow that we are talking about today, cohomology theories. Right. Okay, and here's a simple example of it. Another cohomology theory. I mean, the cohomology theory that we already saw today was the Rahm cohomology. And now here's another cohomology. Oh, by the way, what was in the Rahm cohomology? Did you all spot it? How are we mapping our differentiable manifolds into abelian groups? Here's how it works. We have the differential P forms that are closed and the differential P forms that are exact. Every exact one is also closed because of D squared equals zero. But not every closed one is exact. So you can look at the closed ones modulo the exact ones. That's a vector space. And a vector space is, among other things, an abelian group. That's the abelian group. So you get this abelian group for the zero forms, one forms, two forms, three forms, etc. So these are the abelian groups that you're mapping out your differential manifolds into. So then if these abelian groups differ between two manifolds, the two manifolds must be different. If the abelian groups are the same, you cannot conclude that the differential manifolds are the same. Okay, now here's just quickly another example. K-theory, which has come up in string theory, for example, is another cohomology theory. Again, what is its task? Well, input differential manifolds, output abelian groups. How does it do it? Well, K-theory uses the fact that there's not only one way to put a vector bundle on a differentiable manifold. In particular, remember this case, you have a manifold with a hole in it, then you can put vector bundles on there in such a way that the there are local isomorphisms but not global isomorphisms. And that means that you can put more than one vector bundle on there, and you can have non-isomorphic vector bundles there. And if you look at the set of vector bundles that you can put in there, and you can turn that set into an abelian group by a construction that is called Whitney's generalization of the direct sum, and so you obtain another cohomology theory. Now, however, and now we are coming down from the stratosphere of mathematics, let me just say that this is all good and fine, but it cares about holes and handles that the universe probably doesn't have. Okay? So it does come up, for example, in non-abelian gauge theories in particle physics. It comes up when you look at, for example, Berry phases or geometric phases in quantum mechanics with solenoids, for example. There are examples where, for gauge theories, this kind of mathematics comes up, but for space-time itself, we have so far no evidence of large-scale topological non-triviality, like the universe is a pretzel or a donut or something. There's no evidence for that. Therefore, for general relativity, so far, it's completely sufficient to just look at the local properties, such as curvature and torsion. So in torsion, we also don't have evidence for, but could be there. So in particular, therefore, in this course, we will not do anything further, almost nothing further, about the large-scale topological non-trivialities. Instead, we will look into curvature, which is locally defined, right? So this is what we come back down to, and curvature is also going to be highly non-trivial. The next thing we will do is another derivation of the algebra of differential forms. After the exterior derivation, we will do the so-called inner derivation of differential forms. That's what we will do next time. I'm sorry that I went way over time today, but I thought this category stuff is just a nice extra.